Bye-bye. Sherry, no caller at the moment because we're just about out of time, right? Okay. Well, I'm going to conclude with wishing all you poly people play and eat and have a happy, joyous holiday and do it with people who see you. Today's theme was all about being seen.
Dr. Tony, what are you doing for Thanksgiving?
I'm having Thanksgiving dinner in a restaurant with one of my exes. One of my recent poly triad partners. So how, as we hear this beautiful music from the movie Same Time Next Year, sung by Johnny Mathis, and I think it's Jane Oliver, I'm not even sure, but Johnny is the male voice. Everyone have a happy Thanksgiving, no matter how you celebrate it, no matter how you what you eat. Eat a lot of food, regardless of your dietary preferences and restrictions, and enjoy the holiday. I'll be back on the second Wednesday in December. I'm here the second and fourth Wednesday morning of every month. I look forward to your calls on the next show. I'll talk to you in December. Happy holiday, everybody.
This is KBOO Portland.
You are listening to KBOO Portland. Make sure to tune in on Wednesday, November 26th from 6 to 7 p.m. to vote for the president of the Youth Collective. We want this to be an unbiased, fair election, and that's why we need you to vote. But really, you should be biased. Biased towards me. Why? Well, we have my dear radio teacher, Jacob, here to tell you why you should vote for me.
Well, pretty much the greatest student in the history of existence. GPA is 100,000% out of 4. How dare you vote for anybody else?
That is why you should vote for me, Elizabeth, for president of the Youth Collective. Thank you so much, and make sure to tune back in on November 26th, 6 to 7 p.m. to vote for me.
You are listening to KBOO 90.7 FM Portland, 104.3 FM Corvallis, and 91.9 FM Hood River. Did you know that KBOO is one of the oldest community radio stations in the nation? We've been on the air for 57 years, thanks to the passion and dedication of our volunteer network. In fact, KBOO has more than 300 active volunteers, all helping to create original programming that reflects Portland's cultural diversity and grassroots activism. But we can't do it without your support. Fewer than 10% of KBOO listeners have taken that next step to become a sustaining member. Help keep KBOO on the air for another 50 years by becoming a monthly supporter today at kboo.fm/give. Tell your neighbor, tell a friend, every flower got a right to be blooming. Cause all the freaky people make the beauty of the world. All the freaky people make the beauty of the world. Cause all the freaky people make the beauty of the world. All the freaky people make the beauty of the world. Cause all the freaky people make the beauty of the world. All the freaky people make the beauty. Welcome, humans. I am ready for you. Welcome to NeuroEmergent, the podcast about neurodiversity in the Pacific Northwest and beyond. I'm your host, Carrie Stewart Lingle, and I am actually autistic. My guest in the studio today is Toby Raitz, Executive Director of the Autism Society of Oregon. Toby plans to retire at the end of 2026 after leading the nonprofit since 2011. Welcome to the program, Toby.
Hello, thanks for having me.
The Autism Society was founded in 1981. And you've been executive director since 2011. Can you give our listeners a quick overview of the organization and the services that you provide?
Oh, wow. So a quick history is, yes, we do date back to 1981. We were founded primarily by parents of children who, at that time, had an unusual diagnosis of autism spectrum disorder. In the mid-90s, we became the state affiliate for the Autism Society of America. But we are pretty much an autonomous organization. We raise all of our own funding, and it stays here. here in Oregon. Primarily, our mission is to help people find and access autism resources in Oregon. We also do some programs in Southwest Washington because, you know, we're based in Portland and it's right there. And I felt really bad to say no. But like I said, our primary mission is to help people find and access autism resources. We do that for people of every age, some very young through elderly. We do not charge for any of our services, and you don't need to have a formal diagnosis to access our services. It has also become important to say that we're not a government entity, and we don't receive any federal or state funding, so we don't have any reporting requirements, and we don't put any limits on who we serve.
I would like to get into some of the specifics of those services, which I think, you know, if anyone wanted to know, they should go to your website, which
Absolutely. Is
autismsocietyoregon.org.
Correct. No of, just autismsocietyoregon.org.
And then if you hit on the events calendar, you will see a lot of stuff. Now, you include some things from other organizations, but you also have, online and in-person support groups that you sponsor and organize. You have sensory-friendly movie nights in towns all across the state.
Yes.
So there's a lot going on there. So can you tick off some of the most important things that, you know, take up most of your time and energy, because the services provided vary rather widely.
Yes, they do. We do host or sponsor some 25 different support groups throughout the state. Many of them are online, so they can be accessed by anybody, anywhere, and really out of the state as well. We do have some that meet in person, and our groups range from groups for autistic kids, autistic teens, autistic adults, young adults, no age limit adults, and older adults. It's 40 plus, which is not old to me, but older is how we say it. And then we also have groups for parents of autistic children of all ages. We have a group for Spanish-speaking parents. We have a group for autistic adults who are parents, whether their children are autistic or not. And then we've just started a new group for, this is for partners of autistic adults. And so, like I said, most of the groups meet online. Some do meet in person. Basically, we leave it up to each group to decide. They're all peer-driven and peer-facilitated, because we are not therapists, and we do try and make that really clear. These are support groups. These are social groups. They're not therapy groups. But in addition to our support groups, we also do a lot of events. We have a terrific events director named Tess Hudson, who's in charge of those, and they've done a terrific job of extending the events that we have throughout the state. We have sensory-friendly movie nights, generally monthly, and in several different locations. And, you know, always looking for more partners and sponsors to extend those. We also have sensory-friendly swims, and those, we help sponsor one in Redmond, Oregon, in Central Oregon, but we also have them here in Portland through Portland Parks and Rec, and every month we're at a different swimming pool. So those are some of the things that we do on a monthly basis with the events. We also have community events that happen seasonally. So we are in the midst of preparing for our sensory-friendly Santa events, and those are all over the state, from La Grande in eastern Oregon to Medford to Florence to Eugene to Salem, Portland metro area, pretty much all around. And then we'll do sensory-friendly Easter egg hunts in the spring, and our autism walks, and there's just all sorts of events going on. And by the way, I wanted to make sure to mention our programs director as well, Lori Ball. She is the one who's primarily doing the answer, providing the resources and information, as well as supporting the support groups. And it's a lot.
You have an annual budget of about $500,000 a year, is that
correct?
Right? Your only sources of income are donations, and then you have fundraising events. And I looked at how much you're making from that, which is more than half your budget, and how much you are spending on overhead, which was very low. And I thought, wow, these people must be super smart. What are they? What are their fundraising events? And I said, oh, it must be the walks.
Yes,
so
and the
tell
golf
me about
tournament.
The walks and the golf tournament, because those are events, but those are events that fuel and feed all the other events.
our primary fundraising is through donations and our fundraising events. And two of our biggest fundraising events are our Autism Walk in Portland, and we also have a golf tournament. We actually have five Autism Walks. So we have walks in Astoria in northwestern Oregon. We have a walk in eastern Oregon. We have one in Salem, in Eugene, and we have Portland. And the Autism Walk in Portland is sort of the granddaddy. That's been going on for, 20 some years now. So it predates me. The thing with all of our autism walks is they are fundraising events. They are also community events. So we have a number of community resource tables there so people can get information. We also, it's a place to meet other members of the community. It's an accepting environment and it's an inclusive environment. It's also just a place to have fun.
So if I understand correctly, you moved here originally from the Washington, D.C. area?
Yes.
With your husband and two young boys at the time who had both been diagnosed with autism.
Yes.
And one of the first things you did was look up the Autism Society. Tell me what that experience was.
When we moved out here, so I'm originally from Washington, D.C. I was born and raised there. My husband was born in Chicago but raised in Southern California. We had moved back east because my parents were ill. We moved back to D.C. We lived there for 10 years. That's where our children were born. And then after my parents had passed away, we were ready to come back to the West Coast. So we'd moved out here. The boys were 3 and 8, I think, at the time. My 8-year-old had an educational identification for autism, but fully verbal in gen ed classes with some supports. My younger son had just recently been diagnosed with autism. He was non-speaking and needed a whole lot more supports than my older son did. So when we moved out here to Oregon, I did contact a couple different organizations. There was the Portland Asperger's Network, where we did mainly for my older son, and they did a game club that is actually still going on now through Club EMU that my older son really enjoyed. And then I also contacted the Autism Society of Oregon, and they were great. They had some events going on. They gave me some help with finding resources, particularly for my younger son. And I hadn't been out here that long. I'm trying to remember, maybe a year or so, when they asked me to consider joining the board of directors, which is a volunteer position, which I did. And I was on the board for 2 years. And then the executive director at the time left, and I kind of segued into that position. But it was a big goal of mine, and I was really happy to be able to help people who were also, particularly those who were new to the diagnosis or new to Oregon, to access what resources there were, which were pretty minimal at the time.
So what were your biggest challenges as executive director as you took on this organization back in 2011?
One was I'd never done it before. My background had been as an attorney. I'd never run the walk before. I'd been there. I hadn't volunteered at it, though. So that was one of the first things we had to get up and going, because at that point, it was something like, you know, I always used to joke, if it rains in April during the walk, we don't have a budget. So building up the organization, getting myself up to speed, increasing our revenues so we could do more.
Obviously, this was an organization that was doing very good work for a long time that you wanted to support, but yeah. You've also been a mission to expand that. So tell me more about what you're most proud of accomplishing or adding to the mission.
That's a good question, especially as I look forward to retiring. The thing is, the organization was much smaller when I joined it. We were doing one walk in Portland. There were maybe 3 or 4 support groups that met monthly. We have our take a break program, which was there, but we were doing 5 a month. Right now we do about 250 a year. And our revenues at the time were less than $100,000 a year. And now, they've quintupled. And adding new programs. So Take a Break is an evening out for parents of autistic kids, a chance to recharge and sort of renew their commitment to each other. Take a Breather, which we started, I think, in 2018, maybe 2019, is a similar idea, but for autistic adults. It's up to $100 in gift cards for an autistic adult so they can do something that they enjoy. And it's the idea is to help avoid autistic burnout. Also advocating for more resources. Somewhat controversially, we did a lot of advocacy so that autism therapies would be covered by both private health insurance and OHP. Because when I first moved here, you didn't want your child to get an autism diagnosis because that meant they would be denied health insurance services. You know, for example, my son who was non-speaking, if we had said, well, he's autistic and he needs speech therapy, that would have been denied because they denied autism therapies. But he could get speech therapy because he's non-speaking, but we just didn't mention he's autistic. So that's a huge sea change that now, and also autism evaluations weren't covered. And those can be thousands of dollars. Getting autism therapies, autism evaluations, having those covered under insurance and OHP, and that was a separate process, took a lot of time and effort. Now, one of the things that was also covered and why it's controversial was getting ABA therapy covered. And that's very controversial within the autism community. But it's important that by having ABA covered, it also meant that autism evaluations were covered and speech therapy, PT, occupational therapy, those sorts of mainstream autism therapies are also covered by private health insurance and by OHP.
OHP is the Oregon
Health Plan. Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah. Oregon Health Plan, which is Oregon's version of Medicaid.
Yes. So you said it was somewhat controversial and you had an advocacy mission. I want to be more specific about what that means. Does that mean you lobbied the state legislature to change the law? Is that exactly what that means?
Yes. And certainly not on my own. Had some great, great support on this from amazing people like Paul Terdahl, who's a parent, who's amazing. But it's a very complex process. We had to lobby the state legislature. There were other people who were suing to get autism therapies covered for their children in that case. So it was kind of a dual track effort. Plus, in order to get it covered through the Oregon Health Plan or Medicaid, that's a separate process. The legislature doesn't tell the Oregon Health Plan what they can cover. And that's to keep it out of politics. But that means there's a whole separate board called HERC, H-E-R-C, and we had to go through a completely separate process for them.
So when did that law change?
I believe it came into effect in 2016.
Okay.
And people had been working on that for decades.
I'm always struck by that, did an interview with Disability Rights Oregon a couple months ago. And that was about their lawsuit for shortened school days.
Yeah.
And, you know, that lawsuit has been running for years and was dismissed and revived. All of these advocacy missions, they're really marathons. You cannot just say, well, I want to make this change and I'm going to go change it this year. No, it's your lifetime mission and you're probably going to have to hand it off.
And it seems like this is so common sense. This will be easy to do. I mean, another example of that is in Oregon, in order to get the full range of autism resources for a child up to age 21, you need the medical diagnosis and you also need the educational identification. It's not technically a diagnosis because it's not done by medical people, but through the schools in order to get educational supports. The big problem, though, was that for many, many years, the criteria that they were using to determine if the child is autistic in school was different than the medical diagnosis. So you had a ridiculous situation where a child was autistic everywhere but in the schoolhouse. Same child. Somehow they didn't meet the educational criteria, but they met the medical criteria. So making those two criteria the same for the same diagnosis, that seems like a no-brainer. It took, I believe, 11 years to get that to where they now actually dovetail and use the same criteria. It's mind-boggling that took so long.
I did my best to notice when the call came down the line up to the platform. I was brought, but I was kind. And sometimes I get nervous when I see an open door. Close your eyes, clear your heart. Cut the cord. Are we human? Or are we dancers? My sign is vital. My hands are cold. And I'm on my knees looking for the answer. Are we human? Or are we dancers?
You are listening to volunteer-powered, listener-supported KBOO Community Radio in Portland. Volunteer-powered means we create the programming. Listener-supported means you pay the bills. To help us pay the bills, go online to kboo.fm/give and become a monthly supporter today. Welcome back to NeuroEmergent, the podcast about neurodiversity in the Pacific Northwest and beyond. I'm your host, Carrie Stewart Lingle, and I am actually autistic.
I'm talking today with Toby Raitz, the executive director of the Autism Society of Oregon. This actually brings up a change in direction I want to make. Let's start with the hard question, the most difficult for me, because it's the emotional one. So you've talked about your son, Jacob, your younger son.
Yeah.
Now, he passed away 2 years ago?
2.5 years ago, yeah.
From complications from a seizure disorder, is that?
Yeah. So Jakey had epilepsy, which developed when he was about 14. It is a fairly common co-occurring disorder with autism. And, you know, for years I gave the statistic, something like 30% of autistic people also have a seizure disorder, which is epilepsy. Never occurred to me my son would have that seizure disorder. He, as I said, it developed when he was about 14. We had him on many different medications. He was not controlled via medication. And when he had recently turned 18, he had a seizure. He had what they used to call grand mal seizures, and they call them tonic-clonics. He had a seizure, and as best I can understand it, the electrical storm in his brain caused an electrical storm in his heart. Mm. He went into cardiac arrest, and we were not able to bring him back.
I'm so sorry.
Thank you. And the thing is, it came out of nowhere for us. He didn't have any heart problems. He was a very healthy, happy, great kid. So, yeah, it was a huge shock.
I can't imagine how hard that must be to go through. Especially when here's this extra thing, like you've been dealing with the autism and all of those problems for many years, and then it's like that you just got this extra thing thrown on top to make it all more difficult.
Well, I will say, I mean, I used to joke a bit that, you know, the autism being non-speaking, we were used to that. We dealt with that. We'd done our work internally on that, but the epilepsy was really, really hard to deal with because it was, you know, you never knew when a seizure was going to happen. And they were really scary to watch. But yeah, so that in many ways, that was much, much harder than the autism.
Aside from the very difficult personal story, it also just points to so many of the complexities of autism and the autism world. And one of them, of course, is the co-occurring conditions.
Yes.
Which I think they're so common for people with autism to have either epilepsy or OCD, or there are many of these things that are extremely much like if you have autism, your chances of having ADHD are multiple times higher.
I can throw you some statistics if you like.
But it leads to a lot of confusion, I think, about, you know, what is the autism and what isn't. And I think that leads to some of the diagnostic confusion. So with a really difficult, hard segue here, you started the executive director job in October 2011. In September of that year, just the month before, you were interviewed on KBOO Community Radio on a show called Sounds of Awareness by longtime host Paul Van Dyke, who hosted that show from 1999 to 2012. It was a show all about disability rights and disability awareness.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Sounds of Awareness. I'm Paul Van Dyke. Autism is a growing, I won't say problem, but it's a growing issue in this country, and we are going to talk to a lady with some firsthand experience.
And so I found that interview, and I'm going to play
oh, no.
some of it, because I found some things interesting about it. And part of it is how things change over time.
Absolutely.
So,
how do you define autism?
Oh, well, that's a big question. Basically, you know, autism is characterized as a neurobiological disorder characterized by delays or differences in communication, in response to sensory stimulus, and in social interaction.
There are so many things that struck me about that conversation. And you laughed and said, I've been saying the same stuff for 15 years. I'm new to the autism community. I was diagnosed at age 49.
Not unusual.
Not as unusual as I thought at the time.
And you look, it was that, you don't even look 49 yet, so it must have been like last week for you.
I'm 53 now, but it's only been 3.5 years since my own diagnosis. And so I'm learning this language now, or some of it. I had to know something or else I wouldn't have figured out.
Right, right.
That I was autistic.
We talked about the autism spectrum. So there are varying degrees of autism. Some are high functional and some are pretty...
There's definitely various degrees of impacts. And like I said, within my own family, my two children who are, you know, full brothers, born in the same hospital, they vary widely in their level of impact from autism.
One of the things that struck me most is your discussion here about the spectrum.
Mm-hmm.
Because autism spectrum disorder officially begins to exist after this conversation took place. 2013 is when the official diagnostic material all changed, and it became autism spectrum disorder instead of pervasive developmental disorder and Asperger's syndrome and all of these separate.
There was always an autism diagnosis.
There was, but it wasn't called spectrum disorder.
Right.
It started out as infantile autism.
Yes.
Only, right? So, but what that shows, first of all, is that there's this whole dialogue about the spectrum and what that means that is happening ahead of the official language.
Oh, yeah.
Right? And so to hear this snapshot in time, to hear how the language is evolving and, you know, the educational work that you're doing at this time is part of what is putting pressure on the officials who make all the definitions to change their definitions, right?
Right.
So can you talk a little bit about that? Like, what have you learned in 15 years? How does autism or the autism community look different to you?
I will say the bottom line, the main thing I've learned is that everything in autism is controversial. There is always some controversy out there. Starting with the basic. Are you an autistic person or are you a person with autism? Autistic person is identity first language, where person with I think I've got that wrong.
No, you have it right. A person with autism is what they call person first.
Person
language,
first language.
They don't want to attach the stigma of whatever it is.
Right.
So that, you know, you're not a disabled person, you're a person with a disability.
Right, you're a person first language.
And the other?
Autistic person is identity first. And it's a very personal issue, I think, in a lot of ways. But in general, this has been an issue within the disability community because in general, there's been a huge push for person first language. You know, person with a wheelchair rather than wheelchair-bound person. However, it's different in a lot of the autism community and from a lot of autistic individuals who say, I am not someone who has an overlay of autism. I am autistic. It's part and parcel of who I am. It's part of my brain development. You can't remove the autism from me and still have me here. So many autistic people prefer the identity first language. And that's been a divide. I've even heard of an instance where an autistic adult was invited to give an address at a conference, and she planned to use identity first language. And they told her, no, you must use person first language. So which is just messed up in so many different ways, because the idea of using person first language is to honor the person with a disability. And they were telling this person with a disability that, no, she couldn't decide what was felt honoring to her. So I think she ended up not presenting. This is many years ago. But individual people have different views on this. You know, some autistic people do prefer person first language. What I do personally is, if I'm talking face to face with someone, I will use whatever they prefer. Of course, it's the only, you know, it's polite. If I'm addressing a large group or like this, I have no idea who I'm addressing besides you, I will default to identity first language, mainly because from autistic individuals who have made their preference known, the majority preference seems to be for identity first language. But I mean, everything in autism is controversial. High functioning versus low functioning, that is language that's really no longer used. And I think for good reason. High functioning versus low functioning, generally what people meant is low functioning meant you weren't verbal. You didn't speak. But that really underplays the abilities and strengths that someone has, even if they're not able to utilize verbal language. And high functioning was a way of saying, oh, they're doing fine. They don't need help. And that really underplays the fact that you can be very intelligent, but still need supports and help. One of our former board members has two master's degrees. They're autistic, and they need quite a bit of support in their daily life. So it's like, is that high functioning? They're very bright. But on the other hand, they do have very high levels of support needs. So I think that's a much better way of sort of characterizing people is what the level of support needs are.
I'm just a human. I never said I was God.
You are listening to KBOO 90.7 FM Portland, 104.3 FM Corvallis, and 91.9 FM Hood River.
How could our lives once be so together? Now we're apart. I know we can make it, but where do we start?
For more than 50 years, KBOO Community Radio has been dedicated to lifting up voices that are often ignored or marginalized by mainstream media. But after the recent vote in Congress to shut down the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, KBOO needs the community's support now more than ever. So if it's been a while since you've contributed, be our hero today by becoming a monthly supporter at kboo.fm/give.
This is NeuroEmergent. I'm Carrie Stewart Lingle, and I'm talking today with Toby Raitz, the Executive Director of the Autism Society of Oregon. I'm definitely on board with the identity first language, and I've gone through, like, you know, I've gone through an entire journey of that over 3 years, you know, and how I want to talk about it.
And that may evolve yet.
Well, it certainly will, because, you know, so I'm I'm what is, there's a new term, ADHD.
Oh, yes.
So I'm autistic and I have ADHD.
Yes.
Not only do both of those experiences seem integral to my identity, I can't separate them.
Right.
I can say I'm autistic, but I can't say I'm ADHD-ic. Right? There's not even a word for identity first ADHD.
Right.
But my identity, I can't separate my autism from my ADHD. They're both just me. And I think that points to the why it will always be controversial, because language can never capture the full reality. It's always cutting one way or another against competing truths or competing values. And
absolutely. That's very, very well put.
I think the hardest thing for figuring out whether someone is high or low functioning, as they said in the past, or as they say now, if they have profound autism, which is a new term that they are, there are people who are lobbying to get that an official medical diagnosis. So those things are still being discussed and debated. And so profound autism is defined as basically someone with an autistic, a diagnosis of autism spectrum disorder, who is either non-speaking or has an intellectual disability.
Okay.
The point is, there's nothing about autism that indicates high or low IQ.
Correct.
If you have 150 IQ or a 50 IQ, that does not mean you are more or less autistic.
Correct.
Because the things that define autism aren't that.
Right.
So the support needs that often accompany autism may or may not be because of their autism. And you talked about that a little bit with your son, but the quote from you that really impacted me, I love this moment when you...
When your oldest son was diagnosed with autism, how did you react to that? I mean, what...
Oh, it's funny, because my husband and I had the same response, which was, oh no, he can't be autistic, he's far too affectionate. Because we thought that was the marker. That's all we knew of autism at that time. But we also understood that he was having communication delays. And my feeling was, and my husband's, was that, okay, if this label of autism gets him some of the services he needs, fine. You can call him whatever you want to. But we didn't truly believe it.
I love this moment when you said that your reaction was that you didn't really believe it.
Right.
Whatever your concept of autism was at that time, wherever it had come from, did not jibe with your experience of living with your son. But, gotta find the quote. Okay, if this label of autism gets him some of the services he needs, fine. You can call him whatever you want to. And I'm hearing that in a lot of the debate now over profound autism, because the article came out in Lancet, the medical journal, I think in 2021, they're sort of arguing for profound autism. And they argued that it was important to have this diagnosis specifically to identify those people with higher support needs. So the argument seems to be that as the definition of autism has expanded and now includes people like me who are very verbal, on the radio talking up a storm, as that definition of autism has expanded, there are people who say and argue that that has come at the expense of those with the highest support needs. And that is why they need a new diagnosis to identify autistic people who need help versus autistic people who don't need as much help. I don't know whether I agree with any of the arguments or what, but I'm trying to understand this tension between the practicality of, well, I don't care what you can call profound autism, you can call it silly autism, I don't care, as long as I'm getting the help that I need, versus the quest to sort of really understand what's going on scientifically. Because if our diagnostic criteria are based not on our understanding of the condition itself, but just on whether or not we think those people need some help, and what they might need help with is their intellectual disability, not their autism, it just becomes super confusing.
Yeah, I think what it boils down to, and I want to be really clear, I'm not a medically trained person, I'm not a scientist, I was an attorney, and I'm a mom. But I think what it boils down to, at least in my mind, is the individual. I think a lot of times when you're dealing with labels and trying to decide what type of autism this person has versus that person, it has some practical use in terms of statistics, for example. But in terms of figuring out the supports that are helpful to this person, I don't think you can get away from the individual. I also, on a personal level, I don't like the idea of there's a tension between an autistic person who has high support needs and an autistic person who doesn't, and somehow one is taking away from the other. And I think I have a very personal reaction to that because those are my two sons. And there was no competition there. They're brothers. They loved each other. And they, like I say in that clip, they are full brothers born in the same hospital 4 years apart and manifested completely differently in almost every category. But they were still both autistic. I don't quite understand. I'm not sure the argument that this is somehow going to help someone get more services if they have more support needs, because it should be an individual assessment. What are the support needs of this person? Even an autistic person who is non-speaking, which is now a newer preferred term, and has intellectual disability, even if you have two autistic people with those same criteria, they're not going to have the same support needs. For example, my son had the overlay of epilepsy, which was a whole different level of support need. I'm not so well versed on how we label people and much more concerned about what the individual assessment is.
So I'm hearing that and taking it all in, but I have some difficulties with it that I want to explore. Well, first, here's the quote from that interview. You give the saying in the autism community that when you've met one autistic person, you've met one autistic person. And Paul Van Dyke responds,
the saying is, and it's very true, when you've met one autistic person, you've met one autistic person.
Well, exactly. And I think that's true with just about anybody, regardless of the category.
It says, well, exactly. And I think that's true with just about anybody, regardless of the category, which, as I put it in an earlier episode, that's the point of the phrase. The point of the phrase about autistic people is very much, rhetorically speaking, the same point in the phrase Black Lives Matter, which is to say, this is something that should be obvious, but somehow isn't, right? Because yes, everyone's an individual, but they need to be reminded that autistic people are individuals. Why? Because of the stereotypes that are being imposed on them. The difficulty for me with this everyone's an individual argument is, I'll talk a little bit just about my professional experience. I was in professional journalism for 25 years. I did a lot of good things well enough that I survived multiple rounds of layoffs. But I had deadline problems. I was a procrastinator. I was a deadline offender, repeat offender. Every year I would have an evaluation with my editors and we would talk about what I did well and what I did wrong. And I would talk about the support needs that I needed. And I talked about how there was a time at my work when we had regular meetings, we had brainstorming meetings, there was this structure around the work that really enabled me to do better work. But as the staff had been gotten smaller and the demands on editors had gotten larger, a lot of that had gone out of the wayside. And what I asked for every year in my evaluation was more communication, more structure, more work with my editors. The response I got was always, yes, that's a great idea, and no action whatsoever. So late in my career, we had a new manager, and I and one other colleague had been working primarily from home for several years. And the new manager and the top manager, they decided that we weren't allowed to do that anymore. They didn't talk to us about it ahead of time. They didn't ask us how we came to work from home so much or why we preferred to work from home. They just said, you're going to come into the office every day, and that's just the way it's going to be. Well, I had been diagnosed with ADHD 6 months prior.
Yeah.
So I went into them and I said, I know you want me to do this, but I have this ADHD diagnosis, so I would like to talk about a different arrangement.
Accommodations.
Accommodations, yes. But that did not open a conversation. It shut down the conversation immediately. Mm. There was no conversation with my managers because it wasn't up to them. It was straight to human resources. There was nothing I could do to get them to change their approach to managing me as an individual. The only way I got anything out of them was with a diagnosis and the Americans with Disabilities Act.
Right.
So this idea that we need to treat everybody as individuals sounds great, but it's really hard to ask a school system to do that, right? It's really hard to ask a justice system to do that.
Well, I think you're misunderstanding what I said, though. I didn't say that we don't need an autism diagnosis. I just wasn't, I'm not sure of the utility of a profound autism subdiagnosis. But yeah, and because I've had a lot of particularly parents approach me about, you know, they don't want to get their child diagnosed with autism because they don't want to label them. Mm-hmm. And my response is always, they're probably being labeled anyhow. And this, a diagnosis is a way to get resources, supports, like you found at mm-hmm. your job, so throughout your life, but all, you know, and also in school and so forth. So I'm not against a diagnosis or getting a label. I guess what I was concerned about was trying to further slice and dice what the diagnosis is.
I'm not against diagnoses either, but I'm sort of just recognizing the difficulties and complexities of it all.
I guess what I'm concerned about is, oh, this person has this type of autism, therefore they get these services. Mm-hmm. And this person has this other type of autism, so therefore they'll get these different services without regard to what that individual actually needs. That's my concern.
And I share your concern, and I think that the because, you know, before we had autism spectrum disorder, we had five related
right.
but separate diagnoses. And, you know, I don't think that was a better way of conceiving of autism than the current way. But I also don't think that the current way is like we figured it all out.
No, and that's why, you know, that's why they keep updating the diagnostic and statistical manual, the DSM, which is sort of the, for people who don't know, it's sort of the guidebook for psychologists and psychiatrists in making mental health diagnoses.
When we talk about the terminology and whether we're going to slice and dice the categories or put them all together and try to figure out, there's no escaping it. It's this relentless process, and it goes on and on. And for anyone who's looking for clarity, It's a real challenge because we're not going to have clarity in our lifetime about the causes of autism right. or even, you know, whether autism is one disorder or many disorders or whether it is an identity that is sometimes a disorder. There's no final answer.
There right? isn't. And it can be really hard to live with that sort of uncertainty because we're human beings and we want certainty and we want answers. I am ultimately a very practical person, very pragmatic. So where I come down on is I don't know these things. I don't know how autism works, why some people are autistic and why other people aren't, within the same family even, or why it can manifest so differently from one person to another. What I do know is, and starting with my own sons, which of course brought me into it, that folks need some help and supports. What can we do to get them the supports they need when they need them? That's what I focus on. And honestly, I leave the sort of more esoteric, abstract issues that just make my brain go into many knots. That's just not something that's on my plate because I'm here to try and help the folks who need help.
The wisdom to know the difference.
Yes. Yeah. I will tell you, I am a control freak, and I don't know if that's a formal diagnosis, but I am a control freak, and I know that. And that was one of the things I had to learn, particularly with my younger son, with Jake, is the sort of the serenity prayer. And I'm not a religious person or a spiritual person, but I had to recognize that there were some things I could do for him. I could get him into therapies to the best of my ability, for example. But there were other things I couldn't control. I couldn't make him talk. So having to live with that uncertainty and that not having that clarity, I think over the years has kind of become second nature, and instead becomes, well, what can I do to help? What can I control?
That is a very practical perspective, and it, I'm hearing the lawyer in you. This is volunteer-powered, listener-supported KBOO Community Radio in Portland. Volunteer-powered means we create the programming. Listener-supported means you pay the bills. To help us pay the bills, visit us online at kboo.fm/give and become a monthly supporter today.
Toby Raitz is our guest this morning on Sounds of Awareness, coming to you from KBOO-FM. In the remaining few minutes that we have, what sort of hope do we have for people with autism as they, say, leave childhood and grow into teenage and ultimately into adulthood?
It seems like in the past, everyone focused on the autistic child, when I think something like 80% of people diagnosed with autism are under the age of 17. There's nothing about autism that limits anyone's lifespan. Those autistic children are going to become tomorrow's autistic adults. And most, if not all of them, are going to be able to contribute to society. But most, again, if not all of them, are probably going to need some supports in order to be able to do that.
This is NeuroEmergent. I'm Carrie Stewart-Lingle. My guest in the studio today is Toby Raitz, Executive Director of the Autism Society of Oregon. Toby plans to retire at the end of 2026 after leading the nonprofit since 2011. Is there anything you would like to talk about? You have a year to go on your farewell tour of the Autism Society of Oregon.
My victory lap.
I just want to know if there's anything on your mind that you would like to talk about while you have an audience.
Well, I would say that, you know, I'm ready for sort of the next chapter in our lives, and particularly with after the passing of my younger son, to make new memories with the family. That in you know, bring Jake with us in our hearts, but it has been very difficult in many, many ways. But it's also difficult to leave ASO because I feel like we are in such a time of turmoil, you know, with all the changes going on. There's real concerns about how the disability community in general and the autistic community in particular is going to be impacted by the change in policies we see. I am also seeing other organizations that do get federal grants having those grants pulled. And they do a lot of good work. And I'm very concerned about how that work is going to be replicated, and how much is going to be, you know, asked of ASO to step into those shoes. And we're not a large organization. We have 3 full-time employees, 1 part-time, and then we have a good network of volunteers who help us cover the entire state. But it's a huge mission and a big mandate. But I'm also kind of excited to see who's going to be my successor at ASO and what they do and how they change the organization going forward, because there's lots more to be done.
I would just like to say, for a small organization, I think the Autism Society gets a lot of bang for its buck. And again, I will just point people to that online calendar. So if you go to autismsocietyoregon.org and go to their events calendar, it'll be very hard to find the one day that doesn't have an event on it. There's almost something going on every single day, online, in person, social events, informative events. So I can see the impact that you're having. It's very clear, and I just want to thank you.
Sure. I do want to point out, if I can, just a couple other things on the website that are useful and important are things like we have a resource directory, which is statewide. We have about 12 different categories with 44 different subcategories for everything from, you know, therapies, from auditory therapies to vision therapy, to things like summer camps or where to get a haircut, attorneys, so forth. Mm-hmm. And those, they are statewide. It's free to list. It's free to use. I would say the vast majority of the resources are in the Portland metro area and down the I-5 corridor, because the resources tend to be where the people are located. We also have a lot of information about autism. We have videos which are subtitled in 7 different languages to give a kind of an overview of autism. We also record webinars about autism resources, about using developmental disability services, that sort of thing. So there is a lot of information on the website, and we definitely encourage you to use it.
All right. Thank you very much. We've been talking today with Toby Raitz. She is the Executive Director of the Autism Society of Oregon. I am Carrie Stewart-Lengel, and this is NeuroEmergent on KBOO Community Radio.
You've been listening to NeuroEmergent, the podcast about neurodiversity in the Pacific Northwest and beyond. Past episodes are available online at kboo.fm/program/neuro-emergent. Once again, that's kboo.fm/program/neuro-emergent. This podcast is presented by Lonesome George Productions in association with KBOO Community Radio in Portland and KMUZ Community Radio in Salem. Our theme music was composed by Doug Lingle. Our production assistant is P.F. Lingle, and I'm your host, Carrie Stewart Lingle. Join me on the fourth Wednesday of every month from 11 a.m. to noon, right here on KBOO Community Radio.
Everyone deserves music, sweet music. Everyone deserves music, sweet music. 7 in the morning, step on the floor, walking through the kitchen and you open the door. Ain't much left in the bottle of juice, because the seeds that you're planting never reproduce. Computer's still running, but your mind is cracked, because the plans that you made never came to pass. Now you're recognizing the times is hard when you're trying to take a bite at your ATM card. Everyone deserves music, sweet music. Everyone deserves music, sweet music. At the age of 15 on the drink and drive, no one ever could seem to empathize. Making babies in the backseat on tranquilizers. Papa never was much of rolling stones. He just liked to sit and drink alone. Mama always tried to do the best she could. She would work all day and come home to cook. But we all vain, we all strange, we all stain. We all love to just complain, but nobody wants to seem to get along. See, we got shame, we got pain, we got blame, we all a little bit insane. So that's why I sing this song, you know, because everyone deserves music, sweet music. Everyone deserves music,
Listening to KBOO Portland. Coming up next is Jazz Lives, right after these news headlines.
Bienvenidos a un breve informativo en su estación comunitaria KBOO 90.7